Kate McMillan, as I'm sure you all know, is one of our silks. Kate was admitted to practice in 1976 and came to the bar in 1981, and she was appointed senior counsel in 2000. And putting aside those formalities, if I may, Kate is well experienced in matters of ethics. And for somebody who's been at the bar for far too many years, can I say I can think of no one who is better qualified to speak on matters of ethics than Kate. You undoubtedly will recall and know that she was a former chairman of the Victorian Bar, but more apposite for this morning, she was also a member of the Ethics Committee of the Victorian Bar for many years before becoming its chairman. So she's had much hands-on experience in dealing with ethical matters and issues over many years. And she has appeared in many matters involving ethical duties of lawyers, both before the former Legal Professions Tribunal and the current division at VCAT. Please welcome Kate.
Thank you, Bryn, for that fine welcome. I've always thought that I was indebted to Bryn because on the subject of ethics, because he was the one that got me onto the committee. And like many of you, when you read the rules, you sort of think, well, I didn't realise they were all of these rules were here. But my experience on the Ethics Committee was invaluable, and like many things, you often get more out of it than you think. But it made me very familiar with the rules, and I was absolutely astonished at the diversity of the ethical problems that would arise. So I put it all down to Bryn that I'm here today. Bryn, of course, as you know, or may not know, was chairman of the Ethics Committee for 6 years, which is an astonishingly long time for such an arduous task. And I'll come to it a bit later as to what our Ethics Committee does. I've produced a short little few pages to tell you as a bit of an overview and repeat what Bryn has said in terms of what our duties are in terms of our ethical obligations. And the first, I won't read it out, but the first case that I've referred to is Ginarelli and Wraith. And I've set out an excerpt there which talks about what the duty of counsel is, but today we're going to also talk about the conflict you might have when solicitors and counsel might go awry between themselves. The other case that I've referred to is De Orta Ekaniah, I think it's pronounced, which is more recent, I should say. But the case again accentuates what the High Court has said previously, that is to say, the first duty of a barrister is not to the client but to the court in which the barrister appears, and the duty to the instructing solicitor or the lay client is secondary. And from time to time, I think people find that a little bit surprising, but it's sort of written in concrete that that is the case. We, as the Victorian Bar and the other independent bars of this country, have promulgated bar rules and for professional conduct and practice rules. They're available on our website, and the solicitors have their own conduct rules, and I'm more familiar with our rules, but my memory of them is they essentially mirror the types of things that our rules say. In addition, now you have to consider the Civil Procedure Act 2010, which provide certain obligations as well. I've set out the duties of counsel on pages 2 and 3, and I won't go through those because, of course, you'll know them, but it's helpful to have them in a list that you can refer to very easily, and there are some references to that. Our Ethics Committee has a long-standing practice for barristers to obtain rulings where there's a problem that occurs. Now, this occurs daily, and the Ethics Committee is available on a 24/7 basis, and I can tell you it is used regularly. As when I was chair, I'd get calls on every day. It might be someone just touching base to say, what do I do? Or it might be of a more serious or complicated matter, but it's an invaluable committee that we have and a service that we have. And I know the barristers appreciate it, and I hope the solicitors do. It's a system whereby we would ask the barristers to, if they had time, to put the problem down in writing so it could be circulated to the committee, so you get the input of the 14 or so members. And generally, there's most people on the committee are able to respond depending on their current circumstances, but it does mean that you get a very good input into the problem from everybody's different perspective. The committee comprises people who practice in various areas, so that, for example, if I got asked a query in a criminal matter, I'd be and was most grateful for the criminal barristers on the ethics committee, and also the family law barristers. There are probably more issues arising in those two jurisdictions than any other jurisdiction. We also at the bar encourage the practitioners to use the ethics committee, and what would normally occur is that we're able to respond in writing or by telephone, but preferably now in writing because the our jurisdiction's a bit limited with the new Act with matters going to the Legal Services Commissioner. So a record in writing of the factual situation and the response is invaluable for two reasons. It helps the barrister know what to do. And the second reason is if from time to time clients may complain about the barrister, and the barrister can say in his or her defence that this is what I did and this is the ruling I got. And as far as I know, the commissioner does take those matters into account. And the barrister can say I acted reasonably in doing what I did because I had the advice or the ruling from the committee. From time to time, conflict issues might arise for a barrister, and I have had that occasionally, and if there's a problem there, I mean, generally you would know whether there's a conflict, but sometimes possibly one gets a little bit attached to trying to do things, but a very easy way to solve it is to suggest to the solicitor that you get a ruling from the ethics committee and you'll be bound by that ruling. My sort of general rule of thumb is that if you have to ask, you probably shouldn't be doing it. But it does help if you can have that comfort of someone else independent looking at the problem and removing yourself a little bit, and you can achieve the end result. Today I wanted to talk about a couple of problems that emerge and the application of the rules. And my feedback from people talking to me about this topic was not so much, a paper to it, but to talk about actual practical problems. And I've extracted about three, and you might have some that you might like to throw up in the course of the discussion. But my discussions are going to relate to Rule 29 and Rule 73 of our rules. Now, Rule 29 is the rule that talks about lying, cheating clients. And we've probably all had them. I've had a couple of experiences where I've conferred with the client in conference and I've been given a set of instructions, and then in court the client tells a different version of events, and you don't necessarily know which is the lie, but you know you've got two different stories. In fact, last year I was in the family court on a complicated trusts and property dispute, which is my defence as to why I was there, and the client told us one story in conference. The correctness of that story was challenged by counsel on the other side, and by the production of documents that we hadn't seen. And on the weekend, we sat down with the client to get his instructions about the new documents and what that meant. And we were confident that we had an accurate story and version of events from the client's point of view, so that he could be cross-examined about it. And he, when he was in the box, he told a completely different story to the first two. And Nahum Mushum was hearing the case and he looked a bit surprised, so I asked for it to be stood down and said to the client, what's going on? And he said essentially that he's lied three times. There was a fourth story. And our rule covers that situation. And I was sort of very thankful that I did know what to do, because we had, over the years, had recourse to Rule 29. And I'll just read the rule for you, and I'm not sure whether you'd be familiar with it, but from the barrister's point of view, the obligations of the barrister are spelled out very clearly. And a barrister who is a result of information provided by the client or a witness called on behalf of the client, learns during a hearing or after judgment or decision is reserved and while it remains pending, that the client or witness called on behalf of the client has lied in a material particular to the court, or has procured another person to lie to the court, or who has falsified or procured another person to falsify in any way a document which has been tendered, or has suppressed or procured another person to suppress material upon a topic where there's been a positive duty to make disclosure, must either refuse to take any further part in the case unless the client authorises the barrister to inform the court of the lie, the falsification or the suppression, must promptly inform the court of the lie, falsification or suppression upon the client authorising the barrister to do so, but must not otherwise inform the court of the lie, the falsification or the suppression. So in the sequence of events that I've just described, we sat the client down and told him of what our rule required. On that occasion, he did instruct us to inform the court of the lie. The judge stopped us saying, in fact, what the lie was, stood the matter down and essentially told us to go and settle it. But had we gone on with the lie being exposed, it made not only... the case for the client deteriorated dramatically, because we couldn't believe him, and the family court, or certainly the experience I've had, it's a very emotional jurisdiction. It's people often haven't worked through their issues, and I think the client thought that if he did this, no one would work it out and he'd get away with it. And the lie that he had exposed... That had been exposed, I should say, was the hiding or removal from a bank account of a substantial amount of money that should have formed part of the asset pool, and it was in the range of hundreds of thousands of dollars, so that he sort of shot his bolt in terms of any realistic outcome for his case. And it made me think, why would he do it? And I couldn't get an answer in my own mind as to that. I had two theories. I think that at some stages he certainly showed difficulties of coping with his situation and what had happened to him. And I think he was depressive, stroke suicidal. But the other side of it is, I thought that he probably thought he could get away with it. Now, it's simply that rule provides a great break in terms of the barrister's position. I could have gone and got a ruling if I felt that I needed to, but I did get instructions to disclose the lie. The judge offered a certificate under the Evidence Act to the witness, for incriminating evidence, but it didn't have to go that far because we did end up settling it. But it was hard work getting the client to understand it, getting him to understand not only our position as counsel, the judge's position as what in terms of what he may end up finding against the client, and the client himself. And it's probably the only time where I have spoken to the court in the absence of all the customers, and the judge handled it beautifully in terms of sorting it out and enabling at least negotiations to continue. But I retell that story in that it exemplifies how that rule helped solve a problem that could have been terribly nasty and difficult for everyone concerned. The other rule that I wanted to refer to was our Rule 73, and that's the circumstance where a barrister may from time to time decide or form the view that there may be grounds where the interests of the barrister conflict with the interests of the solicitor. And I don't know about Brendan and Phoebe whether that's occurred for them, but only once in my career at the bar has that occurred. And our rule provides that if the barrister believes on reasonable grounds that the interests of the client may conflict with the interests of the constructing solicitor, i.e. read the solicitor is negligent, in the example that I had, or that the client may have a claim against the instructing solicitor, the barrister must advise the instructing solicitor of the barrister's belief in writing. If the instructing solicitor does not agree to advise the client of the barrister's belief, the barrister must seek to advise the client in conference in the presence of the instructing solicitor on the barrister's behalf, provided that if such a conference has not or cannot be held, or if the solicitor refuses to pass on the advice, the barrister should consult the Ethics Committee for the appropriate procedure to follow. The experience that I'm about to recount in respect of that rule for myself was that we were briefed to do a case for a client, and we drew the statement of claim, and the solicitor did not do anything, really anything. So we kept chasing the solicitor up, saying, you need to do this, you need to do that, and we had memorandums going forward, and we'd ring him and say, have you done this, have you done that? And for some reason or other, whether it was head in the sand or inability to cope, the solicitor did not do anything. And it got to a stage where the limitation period was coming close in terms of a particular matter in it. So we put our thoughts in writing in the form of a joint memorandum. We set out all of the things that we had asked to be done and should have been done and the consequences of it not being done. We also included in the memorandum that this should be brought to the attention of the client, either by way of sending the document or having the client come in for a conference. And I think the solicitor was relieved in the sense that it brought it to a head. He wrote back and sent us the correspondence to say, show that he'd sent the memorandum to the client. And the upshot of it all is the client did stay with the solicitor for a little bit longer, but again the solicitor failed to do any of the work that was required for the proper preparation of the case. And I must say, to our relief, and probably to the instructing solicitor's relief, another solicitor took over the matter and we were able to get it ready for trial and go forward on that. But it was a difficult process to go through, and it was difficult even putting pen to paper in terms of the memorandum and saying that to the solicitor. But we had to protect the client's position, and it wasn't doing the solicitor any good by just not doing anything. And in the course of undertaking the tasks that I've described, we found Rule 73 invaluable. Because I'd been on the Ethics Committee, I'd had experience of the use of that rule before. It's the first time I've had to use that rule myself, and it was certainly the first time that the junior had to use that rule. And he found it invaluable in terms of the experience of having, or the whole experience in terms of how he and we should be operating in terms as professional people, and not only looking after the client, but looking after ourselves and looking after the process of the court proceedings. We always say in this jurisdiction that the one thing we have that's most valuable is our reputation. And I think that our rules and the solicitor's rules, if they're followed, enhance that reputation. You only have to make one wrong step in terms of one's integrity or honesty for people to know or put your name in a black book. I want to know when I'm dealing with counsel and solicitors that their word and my word is my bond. If there is ever a miscommunication or misunderstanding, the obvious thing to do is to repair it as soon as you can. And I've found generally where that occurs, people are very understanding. Often with counsel, you'll have perhaps miscommunication, and that's simply that you're coming often from different parameters and you may have misunderstood what was said. But my rule in terms of dealing with counsel and trying to negotiate settlements of matters or how to go forward in matters is to take a note of what the barrister on the other side is telling you so that there's no error in my mind as to what I said. And often my view of that process is that I think that the other side appreciates that, because in articulating what they want, you can get it clearer for both of you. And as we all know, in litigation, emotions do run very high from time to time, and often things can be misunderstood. Now, I've got another example which I'll just briefly go through. Could I have my coffee, please? Thanks. I've never talked this much so early in the morning. Thanks. At the bar, the Ethics Committee runs courses on ethics for the readers. And that too is an invaluable experience, because most readers are coming from a background of being a solicitor and are not familiar with our rules. And it's interesting seeing the reaction of the readers to the various problems, and they vary dramatically, but most of them are pretty good. You can generally pick out very quickly who's going to be the ragtag in the group, and whether you might see them again. One of the examples, which is an example of one of the rules I've been speaking about, that we give is a situation where the barrister's representing the wife in a family law matter, and in that family law matter there's a dispute as to the length of the party's cohabitation. Surprise, surprise. The wife asserts a 12-year relationship and the husband a 5-year relationship. And it goes to tell me about men. The husband says that the parties had two periods of cohabitation interrupted by a period of separation of 2 years. The barrister conferred with the wife the day before the trial, and during the course of the conference, the wife admits that the parties did live separately for 2 years, as alleged by the husband, and that they had separated in order to assist the husband, who was then involved in property law proceedings in the family court with his first wife. The case commenced the next day, and these are real examples, not just made-up ones, and while being cross-examined, the wife gave evidence that she denied there was any separation, and she steadfastly maintained that the parties' relationship spanned a period of 12 years uninterrupted. What would you do? The barrister stood the case down and came to the Ethics Committee and said what had happened, and Rule 29 was used to solve that problem. And I don't know what the outcome was, but unless the, in terms of the actual case, but the reality in terms of the rule was, the barrister had to either, with the instructions of the client, inform the court of the falsity of what the wife had said, or the barrister would cease to act. Now, in handling a situation like that, the judges know pretty much what's happening because, without saying it in openly, in that if the barrister comes along to say that he or she can no longer appear in the matter, it signals what the problem is in any event. But it just emphasises to me, as soon as there's a lie like that, the case or the strength of the case that you're representing is tumbling backwards at a fast rate. The other thought that I had in terms of this type of topic is to emphasise the duty of an Australian legal practitioner of not to mislead the court. And it's a trite statement, but it needs to be said time and time again. But my view is that duty ties in with the rules that I've already set out. And I think it's most important for practitioners to remember that your first duty is to the court. Now, I've just about run out, so that'll be it, and I think I'm on time. Thank you.
I'm sure you all found that very enlightening and of assistance, and it really does, I think, emphasise the need to make sure that there is no misleading of the court. And as Kate said very early on, it's very much the sniff test. If it smells like there's something wrong, there almost certainly is something wrong.